With the budget out of the way, our state lawmakers turn to lots of other policy issues. Some more high profile than others.
Depending on who you talk to, it is either the savior of Arizona education, or it's in fact a plot by the Obama administration to create little drones out of our students.
I'm Mark Brody. Today on the show, the legislature and Common Core, again. Also trying to cap university tuition and trying to bring new life to a North Phoenix intersection, teaching compassion to aspiring social workers, and where do Phoenix's thespians go?
If you're a member of Actors Equity and you're looking to make a living in Phoenix, you really can't do it just exclusively by acting on Valley stages.
Plus billboards as art and more two-wheeled parking in Tempe. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. In Valley traffic right now, a couple of problems on the 101. On the 101 southbound in the East Valley, an accident blocking the exit ramp to the 202. And on the 101 northbound, the HOV lane at McKellips is blocked. Elsewhere, an accident I-10 westbound at 40th Street. Look for partly sunny skies to continue for the rest of the afternoon. Partly cloudy skies on the way for tonight with overnight lows in the lower 60s. Sunny and warmer for the weekend with highs in the mid to upper 80s. It's 78 degrees right now. Phoenix officials say they now suspect the city's staff knew more than previously believed about changes in impending aircraft routes that have drawn complaints of noise in historic downtown neighborhoods. Phoenix officials have said they were blindsided by the new arrival and departure routes the FAA implemented for Sky Harbor last September. But City Manager Ed Zuercher told Mayor Greg Stanton and City Council members in a memo this week that recent questioning of city employees indicates city staff had advanced contact with the FAA that wasn't previously known to top city officials. Zuercher says the city is continuing to investigate what was known to whom and when, but he stresses Phoenix still contends the FAA didn't provide proper notification and consultations. Starting this weekend, Arizona high school students are participating in regional robotics competitions. They're part of a larger event involving tens of thousands of young people around the country and the world. KJZZ's Kate Sheehy explains the goal behind the competition is to inspire students to explore careers in science and technology.
A group of Mexican immigrant students from a low-income Phoenix high school made waves when they beat MIT in a robotics competition several years ago. A documentary and feature film have brought the student success to the big screen. Alberto Esparza says the popularity of the story is motivating young people.
It's the impetus that really inspired them to even look at careers in engineering.
He's the president of Si Se Puede, or Yes We Can, a foundation that has been involved with the competition for 10 years. Esparza says they work with students from the poorest schools in the Chandler Unified School District. He says this year's team is under the wing of the same teacher, now retired, who mentored the group that beat MIT. This year, students had to design a robot that picks up and recycles trash. Kate Sheehy, KJZZ News, Tucson.
It was another busy week at the state capitol. The budget is done, but lots of other issues coming up before state lawmakers. Joining me once again to discuss the week gone by is Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. Hi, Howie.
Well, I'm still pulling out my hair, so they must still be here.
One of the big issues that lawmakers dealt with this week and seemingly have been dealing with all session long is Common Core.
Ah, yes. Depending on who you talk to, it is either the savior of Arizona education because it's going to allow us to measure our kids against national standards, or it's in fact a plot by the Obama administration to create little drones out of our students. Needless to say, a lot of strong feelings on it. This week, the Senate Education Committee took up a House passed bill to essentially abolish Common Core, prevent the State Board of Education from adopting any replacement standards that even sound like Common Core, and basically start over again.
Is there any reason to believe that this bill will meet a different fate than the other Common Core-related bills that have not worked through the legislature this year?
Well, the Senate has been particularly unhappy with ideas of getting rid of Common Core and have killed a few bills. But Senator Kelly Ward is making some changes to it that she believes will bring on a few votes, including, for example, saying that, yes, we can look to other states.
Lawmakers also took up the issue of an inspector general, something that Governor Ducey had called for. This would be an inspector general that would basically report to the governor. And it seemed like there was some concern over which files and how many files the public would ever get to see from what this person would be doing.
Well, the whole concept of the inspector general has gotten a lot of attention. Now, the governor did mention it in a state of the state, but we finally got to see details. Well, let's see. We have an elected official hiring somebody, giving that person a badge and unfettered access to all sorts of records and subpoena power. What could possibly go wrong? I think the concern about the public records is that there's an understanding that complaints should probably be secret because it protects the identity of whistleblowers. But when we started asking questions about, well, how do we know what was ultimately found, it was told, well, we'll amend the bill on the floor to allow the release of some of what we found. Now, what does that mean? That's in the eye of the beholder. But there's a great concern that if you're going to send somebody loose to play, the investigative version of Spanish Inquisition, you know, perhaps there ought to be some public oversight on that.
There are also some bills dealing with campaigns and campaign funding and who can collect ballots. How much of what lawmakers have been dealing with this session and specifically this week are sort of remnants of House Bill 2305 a couple years ago, which voters referred to the ballot and then the legislature decided to then repeal rather than put it up for a referendum?
Oh, a lot of it is. I mean, you mentioned the issue of ballot harvesting and making a felon of community groups who go around a neighborhood and say, do you have an early ballot? Would you like me to take it? And then this whole campaign finance thing. 2 years ago, if you were running for the legislature, you could take $440 from any one person. Well, they said, well, you know, we need to update that. So they brought it up to $4,000. Well, and they even added an inflation factor. Well, this week they decided, well, $4,000 isn't quite enough. Let's make it $5,000. And what's particularly interesting is the juxtaposition of what else is going on. This is occurring even as the legislature is trying to kill public financing from people who don't want to go out and solicit $5,000 donations. And, you know, the question is, who does this benefit?
Howie Fisher is Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks as always.
You're very welcome.
The judge overseeing a racial profiling case against Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio has called all parties to meet in his courtroom this afternoon. The purpose of the meeting was to discuss an upcoming civil contempt of court hearing against Arpaio and four other officers for violating court orders. But earlier this week, Arpaio and his second-in-command admitted they committed contempt and asked the judge to cancel the April hearing. Joining me now is KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block, who's been covering this story. Hi, Jude.
Hi, Mark.
So just remind us again what the purpose of this April contempt of court hearing was supposed to be.
The judge set this four-day evidentiary hearing from April 21st to 24th to get to the bottom of how and why the sheriff and others failed to follow the court's orders on three occasions and whether they can be found in contempt of court and face civil sanctions for it. So the violations we're talking about, the first one happened in late 2011. That's when the judge ordered the sheriff's office to stop arresting immigrants just on the suspicion that they didn't have legal status. But the sheriff's office apparently never communicated that order to deputies, meaning that these wrongful arrests continued beyond that date. So that's one. And then the other issue has to do with video evidence. Years ago, the plaintiffs in the case before the trial asked for video evidence of deputies making traffic stops. And the answer then was that there was no video evidence to give them. But it came out just last May that many deputies did record their traffic stops and that there were tons of videos that should have been given to the plaintiffs before the trial. And when that came to light, the judge gave the sheriff's office specific instructions for how to retrieve video evidence from the deputies, but they botched that order too.
But now Arpaio and his chief deputy, Jerry Sheridan, are basically saying, well, we admit that we did do those violations and we can be held in contempt, so there's really no need to spend 4 days sorting it out?
Exactly. And they've argued it's a waste of taxpayer money since they've admitted they did contempt. And they've said, we know there has to be consequences. And they've offered a whole bunch of remedies, including setting up a county fund to pay people who were improperly detained damages, letting the monitor have control over internal investigations, and then even personally paying $100,000 to a Latino civil rights organization.
So now all the parties are meeting in court this afternoon for this previously scheduled meeting. Do you have any sense of what we might expect?
Well, I think the big question hanging in the air is, you know, how does the judge feel about this offer that Arpaio and Sheridan are making? And will he be convinced to cancel the April hearing? You know, we know this judge was thinking about referring this contempt case for criminal charges. Criminal contempt can be punished with bigger fines and even jail time. And the judge, you know, wanted to make sure that there were real consequences for this wrongdoing and that, you know, nothing like this would happen again. So the question is, you know, will he think Arpaio's offer does enough? And will he be willing to give up getting to the bottom of what exactly happened the way that you would in a hearing? And the plaintiffs in the case have that concern. They're trying to convince the judge to keep this April hearing. They filed a motion yesterday to this effect. They point out that Arpaio and Sheridan still haven't explained how the violations happened, the exact sequence of events. And they say without that information, it's impossible to really propose the right remedies to make sure the sheriff's office doesn't do this again.
KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block. Jude, thanks.
Thank you, Mark.
The Great Recession knocked out a lot of big box stores and mom and pops, leaving strip malls around the valley with huge vacancies. And in North Phoenix, District 3 Councilman Bill Gates and others are convinced shops in that area took a hit more than a decade ago when the 51 freeway was built. That, they say, gave potential shoppers the ability to bypass city streets. Gates has been working with businesses and neighborhood activists to revitalize the vicinity of 32nd Street and Shea.
How can we repurpose this neighborhood? How can we repurpose those retail centers and make sure that those are full? Because when those centers are vibrant and the commercial area is vibrant, then the neighborhoods are going to be vibrant as well.
It seems like there need to be stores that, whether we talk about chain stores or whether we talk about locally based stores, that are sort of those anchor tenants. Is that missing from that area?
We have had some of that occur. For example, 32nd Street in Shea, people who know that area know that there was a big K. So there was a Kmart, then there was the big K that was built, large, over 50,000 square feet. When they left, I referred to that as kind of ground zero of the North 32nd problem. We've now been able to get a retailer known as At Home has moved in there. So that's helped to buttress that area. But down in the northwest corner of 32nd Street in Shea, we had lacked a major tenant there. So we've been working with the property owner to do that. And construction has just started last week on a Walgreens that's going to be built on the corner, right on the hard corner. And we've been working with them to make sure that that's designed in a way that really celebrates the North 32nd corridor.
What kind of effort do you think it's going to take to get more businesses, whether it's Walgreens or others, to really see this area as a viable spot?
Well, we think one of the important ways to do that is to make sure that the people who are in the neighborhoods want to remain there, but then also to encourage more people to move into the area. You know, you have more residents in the area, then it's going to be easier to support those local businesses and restaurants. So one of the proposals that's being presented to the neighborhood right now is a Class A multifamily, which would be just north of 32nd Street in Shea.
There has been a commitment to the arts scene in certain areas of Phoenix. Would it be helpful to have some sort of a mini arts district there?
Yes, that's actually a discussion that we've been having with some of the local artists. Very excited. There's a group, you know, there's been a lot of talk about these incubators in the city of Phoenix. You kind of see them more in central Phoenix to get new entrepreneurs started. One of the things we're looking at is the possibility of having an arts incubator in the North 32nd corridor. As well, we have a streets project that we're working on that's going to be started soon. And part of that is there's going to be an arts component to add an arts flavor and use some of the city's arts funding along the North 32nd corridor.
Is this something that's going to need extra funds to be successful?
Fiscal responsibility is something that's very important to me, and that's why we've had limited funds in this. Really, what I believe the city can do is get this process started to get the ball rolling. But in the end, it's going to be private funding, which is going to make the difference. And that's why I'm encouraged by seeing private funding getting involved. We all would like to spend a lot more on this project, but that's just not realistic in this environment. So we need to use those tax dollars very wisely and then leverage that with private investment.
Phoenix City Councilman Bill Gates represents District 3. Councilman, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Still to come, an education advocacy group says it's turning to a ballot initiative because it's lost confidence in the legislature's ability to control tuition rates.
There seems to be an effort to privatize higher education and something of a disdain for higher education.
That's ahead. It's the show. To the Valley Freeway's accidents, 101 northbound in the East Valley at McKellops, that blocks the HOV lane. Also, the 101 southbound in the East Valley, an accident blocking the exit ramp to Loop 202, that's the Red Mountain Freeway. Also, an accident I-10 westbound at 40th Street. It'll stay partly cloudy for the rest of the afternoon. Look for a high of 82 degrees today. Partly cloudy skies on the way for tonight with overnight lows in the lower 60s. Sunny and warmer for this weekend with highs right around 86 or 87 for both tomorrow and Sunday. Right now in Phoenix, under partly cloudy skies, it's 78 degrees at KJZZ at 220.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore of Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership. Debuting the all-new 2015 Outback, 33 mpg fuel efficiency and built for your active lifestyle. Ready now for test drives. Shop Subaru.com.
Scientists have known for some time that children who experience abuse and neglect will continue to be negatively affected even as adults, but it's not always clear how to protect youngsters. KJZZ's Stina Sieg reports on a program in New Mexico that may have cracked the code.
Say hi.
7-month-old Jeremiah is smiling and squirming at the two women cooing over him in a Silver City apartment.
He's a happy baby.
Mm-hmm. Very happy baby.
Yeah. And it's due to all the love that you give him and the time that you spend with him, you know.
That's Carmen Ortiz, who's a friend, teacher, and helping hand for Jeremiah's mother, Katrina Rios. But Ortiz's official title is home visitor for the firstborn program. Ortiz has been visiting with the 21-year-old mother since her first baby was born, about 18 months ago. She'll keep coming by until Rios' oldest boy is 3.
It's nice to have, like, somebody tell me that I'm doing a good job. Because then it makes me feel like I'm doing great. Like, they're on track, so I'm doing good. And it helps a lot.
Firstborn has been giving that kind of help to Grant County parents here in southwestern New Mexico since 1997. It's since spread to many other counties in the state. Anyone parenting a baby for the first time is eligible, regardless of gender or income. The program spends an average of $3,400 per family, or $3.7 million statewide, each year in public and private money. But that's still so much cheaper than most of the other home visitation programs across the country. And for all parents, including Rios, firstborn is entirely free.
I learn a lot from Carmen, and she also helps and gives me advice.
Like today, when Ortiz gently convinced Rios to talk to a counselor about her postpartum depression. Later, as Ortiz and I drive away, she says bringing up things like this is always delicate.
And all I can do is not just come and be a teacher, but I want to meet them where they're at. And then I just walk with them.
Through whatever they're dealing with, whether it's an abusive partner or potty training. And that's making a difference, according to the RAND Corporation, a global research think tank. The group says firstborn children are breastfed longer, have fewer emergency room visits, and fewer hospitalizations than other local children. What's less quantifiable is the benefit parents feel from having someone they can always turn to. In a house across town, 3-month-old Aria Inigis is the star of the show as home visitor Veronica Minus checks in with parents Anna and Sai. Right now, the topic is peekaboo.
She kind of stares at me like I've lost my mind, but that's okay.
That's okay. That look never goes away. My teenage son still gives me that look, so it's okay.
Their connection hasn't always been so lighthearted. Anna Inigis also went through a bout of postpartum depression. She says it took Minus's support to help get her through these first 3 months.
Well, it's a full-time job, so you go to a full-time job and you come home to a full-time job. That was definitely a shock. I'm like, oh yeah, babies sleep all the time, right? No, no, they don't.
And that kind of stuff can blindside you, no matter if you're a first-time parent at 40 or 14. Firstborn has worked with both. As founder Vicky Johnson puts it,
we're all in this together, and we all have something to learn.
That's why Johnson doesn't just see home visitation as a nice thing.
It is an imperative. We as a culture cannot allow our babies and our children to experience adverse childhood experiences. It impacts the rest of their life.
Firstborn may soon get help in this fight. The RAND Corporation is in the process of possibly giving the program what's called evidence-based status. That would make it eligible for federal money and allow it to expand, perhaps to Arizona. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, reporting from Silver City, New Mexico.
When Governor Doug Ducey signed the budget passed by lawmakers earlier this month, he implemented a plan that would cut nearly $100 million from the state's three public universities. That could lead to another increase in tuition rates, which have gone up by about 80% since 2009. Matthew Capalbi of Flagstaff says that trend has to stop, and it's why he's become president of Save Our Students, a group pushing for a 2016 ballot initiative that would cap in-state tuition rates.
For every percentage point, there's a significant number of students that are then priced out of the ability to pursue a higher education. That's of grave concern, considering so many different impacts that a rapidly rising tuition rate has. It puts students and parents in debt. It creates an inflationary bubble that is dangerous to the economy. It's a drag on our housing market. We see this as an opportunity to at least deal with one particular aspect of this higher education crisis that's developing. That's the cap tuition rates at the rate of inflation. Right now, we want to chain it to the consumer price index. But again, the consumer price index later on may not be appropriate. So we're putting language in the ballot initiative that will address the inflation rate issue.
And when it comes to a ballot initiative, that clearly indicates you don't have confidence in policymakers because I presume you think they've made this problem worse.
Yes. There seems to be an effort to privatize higher education and something of a disdain for higher education. And so, unfortunately, as citizens, we don't have the confidence in our legislature or our other elected officials to address this problem adequately. Again, with this recent budget that came out, it seems like it's not a priority or a concern to them to address the issue of the cost of higher education.
Why focus the ballot initiative on just in-state tuition?
We feel that in-state tuition and this cap needs to apply to in-state residents, to citizens of Arizona. The three universities and the community colleges are for the benefit of Arizona residents. So if tuition rates go up for out-of-state residents and they're able to afford it, then yes, that's applicable. But the institutions that we have, the public higher education institutions, should benefit Arizona residents.
Based on your personal experience, why is it that you're so passionate about this?
I come from a working-class family. My father and my mother worked very hard, but they had good middle-class jobs, and they were able to save adequately to provide and at least assist myself and my brothers and sisters to pursue a higher education. Working families here in Arizona no longer have that option with the exceedingly high cost of higher education. So many working families are thus priced out to be able to assist their own children in pursuing a higher education. So subsequently, they take out loans and they go further into debt, and that has an overall bad impact on our state's economy. I have two kids, one's 15, one's 11. I want to be able to afford to send them to college or at least help them in their pursuit of a higher education.
Matthew Capalbi, president of Save Our Students, which hopes to have an initiative on Arizona's 2016 ballot to cap in-state tuition rates at ASU, NAU, and the U of A.
Freeway billboards often contain messages, restaurants at which you can eat, attractions to pull off the road to see, that kind of thing. But a group based in Los Angeles has a series of billboards with a different kind of message. Samantha Frank is curatorial manager for the LA Nomadic Division, or LAND, which is behind the project called Manifest Destiny. And Samantha, what's it all about?
So the Manifest Destiny billboard project is an exhibition that has been ongoing since October of 2013. And basically what it is an exhibition that spans the entire country. So starting in Jacksonville, Florida, we have each artist picking a city along the 10 freeway. And this artist chooses a city along the way and does 10 billboards in that city that are each, we call them chapters. And it's been unfolding along the 10 freeway, and we just had the chapter for Bobby Woods, which opened in Tucson.
Are they on both directions of I-10 or just in one direction?
All of them are facing when the driver is heading west. So
okay.
That's what we, throughout the entire project, has kind of been about this journey westward. And the thematic of the exhibition is about manifest destiny, this kind of loose interpretation by artists about this journey westward and this kind of, you know, the American dream and what that means to them.
Obviously, the name Manifest Destiny brings all sorts of connotations to different people. Did the artists sort of have an overarching theme that they were trying to achieve in each of their individual chapters along the way?
Yeah, I mean, every artist kind of took on that thematic in a different way, and some interpreted it very loosely and some more directly. A lot of the artists, they wanted to make a commentary about the rhythm of one driving across the country and searching for that kind of westward destination of the American fantasy, and how these kind of billboards will disrupt that daily commute or that kind of journey along the way.
So the Tucson chapter is number 8. So where are the next ones? Mm-hmm. Where the next chapter is going to be?
So the next chapter is going to be chapter number 9 by artist Zoe Crocher, who's also a co-curator of the project, and that's going to be in the Palm Springs, California area. And then following that is the last chapter of the project, which will take place at the westernmost point of the 10 freeway in Los Angeles, California, with billboards by artist Matthew Brannon, who's a New York-based artist.
And how long will these be staying up?
The billboards are typically up for about 6 weeks, but it's interesting. One thing that we learned along the way is that billboard companies, because they have to send out people to install and deinstall the billboard vinyls, you know, they won't actually go out and take them down unless someone rents the space. So a lot of the billboards have stayed up much longer than they were actually technically kind of rented for, because the space has not been rented by another advertiser after that.
Samantha Frank is curatorial manager for the Los Angeles Nomadic Division, or LAND. Samantha, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And in case you're not planning a road trip from Florida to California, we've linked to photos from the project at theshow.kjzz.org. Small businesses pop up every year, but within the first 5 years of operation, many of them close. The show's Annika Klein visited one nonprofit that hopes to get women in on the small business trend in a way that helps them survive the formative years.
Cassie Yule is wearing a pair of sterling silver earrings in the shape of half moons. She's building her career on those earrings and the other jewelry she designs.
Well, I think like a lot of handmade businesses like mine, you know, it started as just a labor of love. I was making things because I love to. And then eventually people were like, you know, where do you sell this? Where can I buy this?
The answer was Etsy, an online marketplace for people to sell what they create. About a year ago, Yule quit her job as an art teacher and started her new jewelry brand, Zend Out.
I didn't have any business background. I was just kind of like, this is doing well, but I don't really know what to do to take it to the next step.
Enter Alicia Marseille.
I'm the program director for the Arizona Women's Education Entrepreneur Center.
But they usually just call it AWC. The center had a soft launch at the beginning of February.
So since February 2nd, we have 54 clients.
A client is someone signed up for the center's program, which includes trainings, one-on-one mentoring, workshops, and even the option to take an online business course. And it's all free, which gets to the center's mission: to help women in low-income jobs or with no job at all to become their own boss.
Our goal is to help them to understand that entrepreneurship and small business can be a form of self-sufficiency and a way that they can create more income for themselves and their households.
According to the Small Business Administration, which helps fund AWC, one major reason for small business failure is actually unexpected growth. And that's exactly the situation Yul finds herself in now. She's growing, and she has to figure out what to do about it.
I need to make a business plan. And, you know, I already asked Alicia, I said, when I have this business plan written up, is this something that I can come and show you so that I can make sure that it makes sense? You know, I've got the finances in order for it.
With the help of AWC, she hopes to get through those first 5 years that are so shaky for small businesses. In the meantime, she can keep in mind one of the quotes she engraves on her bracelets. It always seems impossible until it's done. It's the show. I'm Anika Klein.
Still to come, more parking will be coming to Tempe Beach Park, but not for your car.
We want to continue to promote bike riding in the city, and this will add some additional space to Tempe Beach Park, a place that's visited by millions of people every year.
That's ahead. It's the show. To the Valley freeways, a pair of problems still on the 101 in the East Valley. Northbound, the HOV lane at McKellops is blocked. And on the southbound side, just a bit south of there, there's an accident blocking the exit ramp to the 202 Red Mountain Freeway. Also an accident I-10 westbound at 40th Street. What you see outside right now is what you should expect for the rest of the afternoon. Look for a high of 82 before all is said and done today. Partly cloudy skies on the way for tonight with overnight lows in the lower 60s. Sunny and warmer this weekend with highs right around 86 or 87 for both tomorrow and Sunday. It's 78 degrees at KJZZ at 2:35.
KJZZ is supported by International Child Foundation, hosting an international and domestic adoption seminar open to the public Saturday, March 21st, 10 to 11:30 a.m. at Mesa Library, Red Mountain Branch. Info at childfound.org.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The Senate has failed for a third straight day to advance anti-human trafficking legislation. The bill's main sponsor, GOP Senator John Cornyn, proposed changes to the bill's ban on abortion spending in a fund for victims, but Democrats still balked at the wording, leaving Cornyn frustrated.
If we can't get to yes on an anti-trafficking bill, heaven help us.
Democrats want the abortion provision removed entirely from the bill. Secretary of State John Kerry says negotiators working on a nuclear deal with Iran are pushing through some tough issues but have made some progress. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports from Switzerland that officials are playing down the chances of an immediate agreement, though.
Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says, quote, "We are still a distance from saying that we have an understanding." In a sign of how eager both sides are to keep details of the talks secret, both Tehran and Washington objected to different parts of a wire service news report purporting to describe parts of a deal. An Iranian official says the figures quoted in the report are not to be taken seriously, and the White House says there is no draft of an agreement circulating. Negotiators face an end-of-March deadline for a framework announcement, and a final deal is due by July. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Lausanne, Switzerland.
A new study finds that a much-ballyhooed 2008 law that restricted the opening of new standalone fast food restaurants in one of the poorest areas of Los Angeles did not reduce obesity there as hoped. Economist Roland Sturm with the RAND Corporation, which did the study, says one reason the law didn't work is that it still allowed fast food restaurants that did not stand alone to open, for instance, in strip malls.
So it's not that the fast food chains do not open restaurants. There are, in fact, 17 new fast food outlets in South L.A.
Supporters of the law say it did succeed in widening food choices for people in the area affected. Stocks were mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow was down 117. The Nasdaq was up 9. This is NPR.
The Chernobyl nuclear reactor in Ukraine exploded in 1986, but nearly 30 years later, what remains is still not safe. Now, after years of planning, an international project to safeguard the power station is taking shape. A vast structure is being built to cover the reactor. The hope is that, when it's installed in 2 years, this so-called safe confinement system will limit the radioactivity reaching the environment nearby. The BBC's David Shuckman reports from the construction site.
I'm standing at the foot of one of the most spectacular arches I've ever seen. I'm in Chernobyl at the site of the nuclear power station in Ukraine, and rising above me is this great kind of dome that's being built to provide what's called safe containment for the damaged nuclear reactor beside it. This great structure will be the largest movable object ever built on land, and when it's ready, it'll slide on rails over the damaged reactor beside it and try to seal it off for the next 100 years. It was back in 1986 that reactor number 4 exploded and burned for 10 days, leaving a vast mess of radioactive material inside. Vince Novak of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development has led the drive to make Chernobyl safe, and he's clear about why it matters.
Accident in 1986 left ruins of the reactor 4 after the explosions and fire, with hundreds and on hundreds ton of the uranium and at least a ton of plutonium and other highly radioactive material mixed with all these materials that were thrown at Unit 4 in order to extinguish fire and stop the nuclear reaction. This has created a nuclear radioactive materials in a forms never seen before, which pose still a huge radiation risk to the environment, because the quantity of radiation in there is extremely high.
The new confinement system, as it's called, is designed to keep the weather out of the reactor and allow sections of it to be dismantled under safe cover. The project is costing about $1.5 billion, and the assembly work is being carried out not above the reactor, but beside it. Now, an obvious question: with the damaged reactor looming just several hundred meters away from this construction site, is how on earth can people stay safe from all the radiation? Well, a giant wall was erected right beside the reactor, and that keeps the radiation at bay. If you worked at this site, I'm told, on a normal shift over the course of a year, you'd get about the same kind of dose you would from a chest X-ray. I've just been here for a matter of hours. The man in charge of managing the project is Ron Hink. I ask him about the radiation risk.
We have a lot of people that look over us here, but obviously we're monitored all the time. We get checked on a frequent basis. But generally, with the work here, I probably get more dose on the airplane flights going home than I do actually at the job site.
Now, clearly that's different if you get really close.
Very much different. Yes.
Okay, so how hot is it in the most sensitive areas where people do have to go and work sometimes?
Yeah, you won't work a full shift in there, and you probably won't work full time. So it's a rotational type of situation where we monitor dose for those workers.
Because inside there's this, 100-ton lump of this strange lava, this radioactive lava. I mean, how hazardous is that?
Well, that's not on the sightseeing tour, if you will. That is very dangerous, and we restrict access to that to just about everyone except the very critical people that need to get in. And even when they go in, they pretty much move quickly in and get quickly out.
Thousands of people were forced to abandon their homes as the radioactive cloud spread from the burning reactor. One of them was Lenar Sagdulin, who used to work at Chernobyl. He's looking forward to the new safety system and is keen for lessons to be learned.
I think it could not be happened if we had more robust design and a little bit more attitude to the safety culture. But at the same time, you see Fukushima, you Three Mile Island, different countries, but what I would say that nobody is guaranteed from repeating of an accident, because design is design. People cannot predict any possible scenarios of accident. So all this kind of human error. And we should do our best to produce good, robust design. We should keep and we should respect safety culture, improve safety culture, and don't forget about these consequences and lessons learned.
That's the BBC science editor David Shuckman in Ukraine. Social work students at the College of St. Scholastica will be learning more than the ins and outs of the profession. The Minnesota-based school, which has a campus in the Valley, will be offering a course called The Competency of Compassion, which will look at different aspects of compassion over a four-class meeting sequence. Marcia Runberg is St. Scholastica's undergraduate social work program director.
I started thinking about how could I provide a learning opportunity that would ignite their passion for becoming a social worker and also give them the experience of how our program creates an atmosphere of community learning and knowledge and skill acquisition.
So are you teaching your students about the importance of being compassionate or how to be compassionate?
I think we're doing both. Oftentimes the idea of compassion seems like something that's simple, that should come from the heart, and that our compassion activities always do good and do no harm. And actually, that's not necessarily the case. And in professional social work, we teach our students the importance of competence, and that compassion is both an art and a science. It combines skills and knowledge fueled by passions of the heart, but it also ignites a willingness and capacity to see beauty in others and oftentimes really have to deal with very difficult situations.
Is compassion something that can be taught to somebody if they don't already have it?
Compassion comes from the heart, but oftentimes we as social workers or just, you know, everyday people have a feeling that if I offer compassion, if I help someone in need, if I listen to someone that's wounded, that with that compassion, I'm going to really be effective. And oftentimes we're not effective because we're looking at compassion through our reality, through what we think is really helpful, not necessarily the reality and the situation that a client might be in.
Are there sort of practical tips or tools that you can give your students to try to sort of enhance their ability to show compassion to their patients?
Students first need to look at how are they showing compassion to themselves. Self-care is very important for social workers. We use the term vicarious traumatization. Social workers are continually involved in dealing with the dark side. And so oftentimes it's important for social workers to know that self-care is important, and being able to look at oneself and how I am compassionate with myself starts first, and it's something that we really stress with our students.
Do you find that your students have a good understanding of what compassion is and how to show it either to themselves or to other people?
Definitely, I think so. Our students that choose to go into social work don't do it for the prestige. They certainly don't do it for the money. We talk about the importance of a calling not only to a career, but a calling to a mission to be able to give and to offer and to heal. I tell our students that everyone is healers.
Marcia Runberg is the undergraduate social work program director at the College of St. Scholastica. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. We're bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news. You can always find more about our program at theshow.kjzz.org. A small-scale construction project could be coming to Tempe Beach Park. Members of the Tempe leadership class want to build bike racks and envision the project as a way for nonprofits to raise some money by using the racks as a valet during special events at the park. Financial advisor James Wendland and Peter Hodgson, who works with Teach for America Phoenix, are both members of the class working on the project. We met at the site of the proposed bike racks.
We're trying to create a permanent bike structure that will go here at Tempe Beach Park to address some of the, you know, congestion problems we see in terms of special events that happen here, but also just add some much-needed bike parking to Tempe and to the downtown area.
How much demand is there for that kind of thing in this area?
I would say there's a lot of demand for it. We're actually working closely with the city of Tempe, who included this in the downtown parking strategic plan. This is something that they wanted to see because of the, you know, the development that's happening, because of the congestion we see with cars. We want to continue to promote bike riding in the city, and this will add some additional space to Tempe Beach Park, a place that's visited by millions of people every year.
So is the thinking that by having a bike rack, a place for people to park and lock up their bikes, that more of them will ride their bikes to come visit here?
That's definitely the hope. If you've ever been to any of the events down here, specifically Oktoberfest or Tour de Fat, there has been temporary bike valets. And so the idea is that we're creating a space, a safe space for people to park their bikes, and knowing that there's a space here, that people will hopefully utilize that more and more.
James, how much do you think this would cost?
Estimates right now are ranging for the first phase between $80,000 to $120,000. Obviously, the more donors that step up and contribute to the project, cash and in kind, the more elements we can add to the design process.
And where are you as far as fundraising?
We've got about, currently we've raised about $40,000. We've also got some in-kind donations. So we've got a good head start, and hopefully we can start moving some dirt in about the next 6 weeks or so.
How many spots do you expect to have here?
I think right now the design's calling for somewhere in between 120 and 140 actual bike racks. And obviously that's a major increase from the five that are currently at the site. So we're excited about that.
Why this particular spot? We're right on Rio Salada Parkway, basically across the street from where Monty's used to be and where the U.S. Airways building is. So what is it about this spot that's appealing for this project?
It's the visibility, really. As you can see, we're right next to the main entrance to Tempe Beach Park. Rio Salado is a very frequently trafficked road here, and obviously at the corner of Mill Avenue. So the more people see it, it's less advertising you have to do. People see the, you know, people riding their bikes into these big events, and you know, hopefully it'll also make for a cleaner atmosphere with these larger events. You have fewer bikes chained up to trees and things of that nature. So you'll see it there. You'll know where to go. Easy to find.
And I will say, too, in working closely with the city, this is a space that they helped us determine and an area that they wanted to see the valet itself go with it close to the entrance and with easy access to Rio Salado and the bike lane and the sidewalk and things like that. This is a prime spot that the city really wanted to see us move towards, and we wouldn't have done this without their support and their help.
So the spot that we're looking at is kind of a mound. There's grass. There's one little tree up there. What do you have to do to this land to get it ready to actually build the bike racks?
Well, the first thing we're going to have to do is, as James said, move the dirt. And so we'll be working with groups to help grade the space, level it, and work on fencing. There's currently some pretty basic black fencing that goes around the outside of the park. We'll be utilizing the similar, if not the same, design to encapsulate the area while also utilizing the fence that's on the south side of the park itself. But from there, we'll be putting in the racks. We'll be hopefully using decomposed granite and some other paver stones to keep the space nice and level and easy for foot traffic.
Best case scenario, when do you think this could be up and running?
Well, as James said too, it comes down to funding. I mean, we'll be working closely with the city throughout the next few weeks and the next few months. We have different phases of the project we hope to see happen. And so our goal is to continue working on this until we feel like the city and our class sees this as a complete project. So the first phase we're hoping to finish come the mid-May, and that would be the fencing, the grading, the bike racks themselves, and then enhancements throughout the summer. So we're hoping, again, timeline is kind of unknown until we can really, you know, feel that we've delivered a final solid project.
James Wendland and Peter Hodgson are members of Tempe Leadership Class 30, which is currently raising money to build permanent bike racks at Tempe Beach Park.
Earlier this year, Actors Theater in Phoenix brought down its curtain for the last time. That gave the Valley's professional actors even less of an opportunity to ply their onstage trade. How successful can a Phoenix-based actor become? I asked Kerry Lengel, performing arts reporter and theater critic for the Arizona Republic.
This is still not a theater town, you know, a theater destination town. And I don't mean just to rival Chicago. I mean, we're not even at the level of a Seattle or a Minneapolis or another one of these cities that has a really strong core of professional theaters and theaters that are creating new work that sort of move on and have a life around the country. So I'd say, you know, we really have a long way to go if we want to be that. And of course, you know, I'm a cheerleader for the scene and want that to happen. But I don't think it's realistic to actually think that we've gotten close to that yet.
When we have actors, let's say I'll bring up Arizona Theater Company, which obviously uses very professional, very talented actors, but many of them are obviously not from this area. Do large regional theater companies tend to hire actors from outside the community?
Yes, absolutely. Arizona Theater Company is sort of the prestige company in Arizona. They are the only member of the League of Resident Theaters, which is sort of the elite tier of regional theaters. And it is very standard practice in the LORT theaters around the country to, you know, they consider themselves to be on a national playing field, and that is how they look for their artists. So Arizona Theater Company routinely will travel to New York to audition actors, to L.A., sometimes Chicago. They do hire actors here in town, but they look at themselves as being part of a national conversation, and that is how they run their business. And that's definitely the way they do it and is a choice.
So what opportunities do you see then for locally based actors here who are professional? To be frank, I mean, not to look at anyone's bank account, is this a place where actors can make a living?
Yes and no. With the loss of Actors Theater, there are only 4 equity houses, meaning theaters that have contracts with the Actors Equity Union, which is one of the major ways that you would be considered a professional theater. So we've gone from 5 to 4. That's a 20% reduction. That's a huge hit. But there were only 5. So if you're a member of Actors Equity and you're looking to make a living in Phoenix, you really can't do it just exclusively by acting on Valley stages. In order for an actor to make a full-time living, they need to cobble together, you know, jobs. So they'll work for local theaters, but they will also travel. They will be one of those actors who travel to other cities and act in productions in Pennsylvania or Southern California or wherever. And they also teach. They also, you know, work in film and television and commercials. You know, it's kind of a freelance life. You have to really build that full-time living through a large assemblage of small jobs.
Kerry Lengel, performing arts reporter and theater critic for the Arizona Republic.
Since the late 1960s, it's been a community gathering place. It's also the place where notable people from across the country came to support Chicano civil rights. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez tells us the story.
The Santa Rita Center sits near Buckeye Road and 7th Street in an area between Sky Harbor Airport and downtown Phoenix. It's been here for more than 50 years. Did you know Santa Rita Center is where many Chicano social, political, and community movements were started in the Valley?
A lot of the people that live here were working in the farms, cotton pickers and lettuce and all that stuff.
Terry Cruz has been part of the center since the 1960s.
They had all kinds of meetings for the community. This is where the people brought their problems, things that they took to the city, other things that they needed for the community.
Santa Rita Center was built in 1962 by Sacred Heart Parish. The local church used it as a catechism classroom and a community hall. By the late 1960s, the single-story building became a center for a new group called Chicanos por la Causa, an organization created to support and assist area residents. In 1972, a group of Arizona Union farm workers marched to the state capitol in protest of a law enacted to prohibit migrant workers from boycotting, striking, and collective bargaining. Union leader Cesar Chavez joined the rally and announced that Santa Rita Center would be the place where he would fast in protest.
Oh, that little room is where Cesar fasted.
As 87-year-old Cruz makes her way through the center with her walker, she points to the memorable room.
That was something that he was committed to do for the campesinos.
Cruz says she and other women in the community cooked meals for the people who gathered here before a rally or a march. She says the place was always packed.
Tortillas, frijoles, anything. Breakfast in the morning, chorizo, huevos, menudo. Fed them all. Hundreds of people. Then they walked from here all the way to Tollison. And then from Tollison, they walked back here and we fed them dinner.
Next to what used to be the kitchen is the hall where the gatherings took place. Crew says back then the room was set up with folding tables and chairs, but it was often standing room only. The center became nationally known during Chavez's fasting. Well-known people came to support his efforts, including folk singer Joan Baez, Coretta Scott King, and presidential candidate George McGovern.
This was the beginning of a whole community that got to know each other and work together.
Today, Santa Rita's center is owned by Chicanos por la Causa. The center is used for special meetings and events, especially at the end of March, when the community celebrates Cesar Chavez's birthday. And there are plans to restore the building and create a museum. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you know things that we should know or just have good story ideas, please tell us about them. The show at KJZZ.org. A lot of good stuff going on this weekend around town. As always, you can check out the NCAA Women's Basketball Tournament. ASU hosts Ohio tomorrow. That's at 3:30 at Wells Fargo Arena in Tempe. Obviously, a lot of spring training games as well. The Coyotes host the Penguins tomorrow at 6 p.m. Also in Peoria, the P83 Street Party is tomorrow from 3 to 9 p.m. That's on 83rd Avenue between West Mariners Way and Stadium Way. That's right across the street from the Peoria Sports Complex. You can check out the Great American Barbecue and Beer Festival tomorrow in downtown Chandler. You can also check out the Buddy Holly Story Musical. That's tonight and tomorrow night at the Orpheum Theater in Phoenix. The show is produced by our senior producer Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Annika Klein. Tracy Greer and Maria Springs are our digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD.